Sleepwalkers is a production of iHeartRadio and Unusual Productions.
Every day I go to work, I use my car. Every day I talk to somebody that's more than a few feet away, I use my phone. So I'm using certain technologies that extend me beyond my physical normal range. Yeah, so maybe I'm a cyborg.
That's Sebastian Thrun speaking. He founded Google X and he's appeared on Sleepwalkers a few times. As far as we know, he's not a cyborg.
If someone took all technology away from me, like refrigeration and everything, would I not survive? I have no clue how good I'm in catching deer here in my neighborhood. But yes, I would be pretty miserable.
You said something which I found quite interesting. You said, I would love to directly interface my brain to all the computers in the world so I could be truly superhuman. I would know everything, every name, every phone number. If there was a button you could press to do that right now, would you have any hesitation pressing it?
I would press it in a microsecond.
Why?
I'm actually the product of data. I went to college. I read probably 400 or 500 books in a time. And I built a scientific career on the shoulders of others. That data empowered me to who I am. If you took that data away from me and said, Sebastian, I'm going to put you into the China in the 70s. You're going to work in the field. I would be less a Sebastian than I am today because I would probably know how to plow a field, but that was pretty much it.
To Sebastian's regret, there's been a hard limit on how much data he can actually consume. His hardware, his physical body, has held him back.
Unfortunately, the human I.O., the input-output, the ears and eyes and smell and so on, voice, are still very inefficient. If I could accelerate the reading of all the books into my brain, oh my God, that would be so awesome.
We talked in the last episode about brain-computer interfaces in the medical world, helping disabled patients like Jan Sherman move prosthetic limbs with their minds. Today, we look at transhumanism, becoming cyborgs. What happens when we merge with computers, not just to restore function, but to upgrade and enhance ourselves? And as we head into this new future, who might get left behind? I'm Oz Voloshin. This is Sleepwalkers. So, Kara, Sebastian was talking about cyborgs and whether we're already cyborgs because we're so reliant on our technology, our cars, and especially our phones, which become kind of like a second brain, albeit a very distracting one.
Yeah, I think what he was saying is that if technology is required to keep us alive, that merger between humans and machines has already happened.
We're already cyborgs.
That's right.
But let's be real, that's not really what people think about when they hear the word cyborgs. They think about more extreme cases, like Sebastian having his brain directly connected to all the information in the world, ever.
You know, and there are already some people working on that. There's this guy named Elon Musk.
Who's that? Sorry.
That you might have heard of. And he actually, one of his new companies is called Neuralink. And what he's trying to do is create a mesh that can be inserted in the brain that connects the brain to a computer.
Wow.
And I think part of his goal is to make humans competitive enough to take on machines if and when they outsmart us.
Well, this idea of humans and machines merging to create something superior is of great interest throughout Silicon Valley. And one person who kind of wrote the book on this, transhumanism, is Yuval Noah Harari. He's a historian and a futurist and the author of Homo Deus, a book that explores the future of our humanity. And his writing is a major source of inspiration, not just in Silicon Valley, but for this podcast. So I was rather excited when he agreed to have a conversation with us.
Every generation in history thinks that they are on the verge of the apocalypse. And usually they are wrong, but as a historian, I have the sense that we are on the verge of the most important revolution since the very beginning of life.
Yuval believes that right now, we're actually looking at the end of history as we know it, the dawning of a new era. Something has changed. I wanted to know what.
We are really deciphering the underlying rules of the game of life and now acquiring the ability to change these rules. I mean, previously, the expectations of the apocalypse were directed outwards, towards the gods, towards some external entity that will come and intervene and change everything. Now, we don't expect an external entity to do it. We expect ourselves to do it. And when you look really calmly and objectively, at the advances that science has been making, it doesn't sound so far-fetched.
As Yuval would have it, we no longer look to the heavens for answers because we ourselves are becoming gods. And as technology improves, we're getting better and better at finding answers by looking inwards, literally.
One of the biggest misunderstandings about the whole AI revolution is that many people see it as a revolution coming out of computer science. But actually, it comes equally from the life sciences, from biology, from brain science. It's not enough that computers are becoming smarter. It's also essential that we view humans as algorithms. If our feelings are not the product of some kind of extremely complicated algorithm in the brain, then no matter how smart computers will become, many things won't happen, even something like self-driving cars. To navigate a street full of pedestrians, the car must be able to understand human behavior and human feelings. And if you think that human feelings are the result of some spiritual soul or something, which can never be deciphered, then you can't have self-driving cars.
In order to create so many of the technologies we talk about on Sleepwalkers, from self-driving cars to targeted ads to parole algorithms, we have to assume that human behavior can be modeled, that our habits, routines, even our personalities could be expressed as mathematical formulas. But even if you don't take things that far, Yuval's key point about the transformative potential of combining computer science and biology is shared by people in the business of building the future. You may remember Aarthi Prabhakar from earlier in the season. Aarthi ran the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA.
We're living in a time in which the biological sciences are converging with information technology. So at DARPA, we are always looking for these areas where we see these seeds of technological surprise. And today, I think this intersection of biology with technology is one of the most fertile seedbeds for surprise.
And when these advances are coming from the ability to alter biology with computer science, it may be hard for us to predict what surprises might bloom. Yuval has argued that advances in AI and gene editing will lead to new forms of life.
We are now gaining the ability to break or bend or change the rules of life. We are about to create the first inorganic life forms after 4 billion years of evolution. We can't really imagine how the new entities would look like because even our wildest dreams are still subject to natural selection and organic biochemistry.
So, according to you, Valkara, it's rather difficult to say what might come next because it's somehow out of our frame of reference. It's almost like saying, what do aliens look like? And I don't know if you ever watch movies, but in movies, aliens and cyborgs tend to look remarkably consistent.
Yeah, I actually watched Men in Black last week, and it is alien central casting. You know, a lot of representations of cyborgs tend to have this element of cliche. You know, there's a pitiable robot, the robot that's healed by love. You can think of Wall-E, C-3PO, the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz, my favorite movie.
Yeah, it's kind of a fantasy film.
We've actually talked about real-life people who may meet the qualification of cyborg already on this show. We spoke about Jan Schurman in the last episode using a robotic arm with her mind. But the research didn't actually end there. In a subsequent experiment, Jan flew a simulated plane with her brainwaves. Remember, this research was being funded by DARPA, and it raised big questions for Aarthi Prabhakar, who was running the agency at the time, about the ethics of transhumanism.
When Jan went from moving a prosthetic limb to controlling a flight simulator, that was the moment that it became visible that these technologies that allow you to restore function by harnessing motor control signals also mean that now we have a way for a human brain to engage with the world in a completely different modality. It was a very eye-opening moment, I think, for all of us.
What did you feel in that moment?
It's creepy. It's powerful. It makes you realize that as hard as the technology is, it might be the easiest part of figuring out how we harness these capabilities for good in the future.
As we've said, this technology remains firmly in research labs, at least for now. Andy Schwartz is the neurobiologist at the University of Pittsburgh who led the project with Jan. And he's very clear that his mission was to restore function, not enhance it.
The idea was, can we help paralyzed people coming back from war zones regain function? So I think that was a very good motivation for the kind of research we were doing.
And despite the huge potential of Andy's research, he's quick to point out that the brain-computer interface he built is much less efficient than our existing connection to the world. At present, our bodies are the best we've got.
Right now, if you wanted to control a computer with brain activity, it would be 10 times slower than it would be if you were typing with your own fingers.
Things move so fast that we've gotten accustomed to the idea that if you see it once, it's just going to become pervasive. That's actually not true of a medically invasive procedure that involves putting implants on the surface of the brain. We're going to need all of that time to figure out where we want to go with these technologies.
So it's a perfect moment to ask, where do we want to go? For many in Silicon Valley, the principle of a more direct interface between humans and computers is enticing. But here's Sebastian again.
At this point, I don't think customers would love having surgery to get an implant in their brain just to be a little bit smarter.
But there are other ways to approach the problem. You may remember Google Glass. Sebastian led that project when he ran Google X. And in fact, when I first met him in 2012, he was wearing a pair.
We built Google Glass because I wanted a camera right next to your eye and I wanted a speaker right next to your ear so the computer could perceive the same sensation, the same stuff you see every day. I think these technologies become closer and closer to us.
When I first met Sebastian, he was wearing these weird Google glasses, Kara. He kind of looked like a cyborg. And he told me that these glasses might solve the problem of people constantly having to look down at their phones because the information could be at eye level.
But that really hasn't solved the problem of tech neck.
What's tech neck?
Tech neck, women and men are now getting this like very, you know, unsavory under neck fat.
Really?
From looking down at their phones, yeah. And then there's turtle posture, which is people hunching forward because they're sitting at their computers so much. So we don't know if these are going to have an impact on us evolutionarily speaking, but I imagine they might. Our thumbs, if you think about it.
Well, our bodies are already being changed by our interaction with our phones.
Absolutely. There's actually really quickly, there's this fake video that was going around called Lookout, where this guy invented a product where your phone basically had the same camera it does, except it would face out, so you never had to look away from your phone. You could just look at your life through your phone, which is essentially what everybody is already doing.
Well, and that was kind of the insight behind Google Glass, was what if you could overlay kind of an augmented reality over what you saw? And there is something very promising and cool about it, but it wasn't commercially viable because you had to wear something on your face that made you look like a cyborg. But for consumers, the benefits of a computer at that proximity just weren't enough to make up for the inconvenience of wearing something on their face.
There is one group of people who are willing to put up with inconvenient technology. You know, people like Jan, who had her skull opened so that she could move an arm again.
Right. As Andy said, this wasn't about letting her fly planes with her mind. It was about restoring function. When we come back after the break, we look at a much less invasive technology that hopes to be as miraculous as Jan Sherman's robotic arm.
Okay, oh, do you want me to test it with the tambourine and whatever? Okay. How's that?
That's Noé Soja. He's an award-winning Italian blues guitarist who lives in New York. When Noé came to play for Julian and I in the studio earlier this year, he asked that I meet him at the bus stop.
I went to Berklee College of Music in Boston to study jazz guitar performance.
And Noé's the real deal. While he was at Berklee, he was given the Jimi Hendrix Award for being the school's leading guitarist, as well as the Billboard magazine endowed scholarship. And now he plays a consistent roster of shows around New York. But he's working to reach a digital fan base as well. Every day, Noé posts a video to help build his audience. This is how I found him. What you wouldn't know just listening to this podcast is that Noé also happens to be blind.
I was born 3 months early, so they put me in the incubator, but there was too much oxygen.
In his infancy, Noé suffered from retinopathy of prematurity, known as ROP. He needed surgery to reattach his retinas, and now he has very limited vision.
I'm considered totally blind, like 100% blind. Technically, I guess it's called light and shades or something. I mean, I can see colors. I can read really large print only out of one eye, but my vision field is small. So I still use the cane. I still read Braille.
This is why Noe asked me to pick him up at the bus stop. Getting to and from new destinations is a huge pain in the ass. But here's the thing. There are some companies that are trying to fill the gap and make smart glasses for people with visual impairments. Their hope is that with the right technology, blindness could become a thing of the past. When we were researching for this podcast, Julian came across a new technology company.
Yeah, after a few months, I had a pretty AI-focused search history, right? So my Instagram ad started to reflect that.
Which is convenient, actually. You know, AI helping us make a podcast about AI.
Yeah, super considerate, right? So I got an ad for eSight, which presented itself. And eSight billed themselves as creators of the world's most advanced sight-enhancing glasses for the visually impaired. And medical tech can be pretty expensive, but eSight's recently lowered their prices from $9,500 for a pair of these glasses down to $5,950.
What do they call that, a price slash?
Yeah, all sight-enhancing glasses must go. So it's still pretty steep, but eSight has payment plans and health insurance can help people out as well.
Yeah, but even so.
I mean, I'd rather spend money on guitars. You know, like, that's what I do in my life. Like, why would I spend money on something that is still so experimental?
Still, Noe was curious to test out eSight's technology. So I reached out, explained Noe's condition, and we got an appointment. Yeah, don't do anything crazy when you put them on.
What am I supposed to do? Start jumping around like a crazy person? I'll do that.
Yeah, be like, yes! So if it doesn't work, just make it up. Say it. No, I'm joking.
That's funny.
The eSight glasses basically look like Cyclops from X-Men, except without the blinding laser beam that shoots out from them. The glasses capture high-quality video with a camera above your nose, and then project the video to a high-definition screen in front of each eye. The footage is enhanced by software designed especially for people with vision impairment. You can also zoom, change focus, and do things like boost contrast or go to grayscale. An eSight rep named Nigel helped Noe get fitted with a pair, but it can be a little hard to get used to.
I mean, I am trying to see, isn't it like right here where I should be looking? Like,
yes, it should be right in front of your pupil.
Yeah, it's a little high.
Okay, let me see if I can just adjust that.
Yeah, there you go, that's better.
Is that better?
Okay, yeah. Cool. It seems like I get more details out of things, but I don't really know what I'm looking at.
Nigel also asked Noe to identify me.
Let's see if you can recognize Kara's face. So let's just come
I see it.
Do you know what I look like, Noe? Like, do you have a sense of what I look like?
I mean, from what I saw when I was close to you, like, you have, like, light hair, like, either light brown or something like that.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And, yeah. I mean, it's cool. I just don't know. You know, we have to see how useful it would actually be. Like, I mean, I don't think I would use it to recognize people like that because I would have no way of... I don't know what anybody's face looks like anyway, you know.
Because he has been blind for his entire life, Noe doesn't have a point of reference for the details in people's faces. Imagine that you have no idea what any of the people in your life really look like. You learn to identify them in other ways, like their voices. So Noe's ambivalent about the prospect of seeing people clearly, but he would like it to be easier to get around.
Recognizing people's faces would not be one of my priorities, but reading where the bus stop is or when it's coming would be a priority. I mean, it's cool. It's interesting. I would just have to see how it actually practically would be. Because, I mean, here's the thing. Like, when you're outside, it's not that you have time to stop and figure stuff out, especially when you're walking on the sidewalks of New York. Like, I'd rather just use Blind Square.
Noe first told me about Blind Square when I picked him up from the bus. It is the most popular iOS navigation app for blind people. It describes the environment you're in, the intersection you're crossing, and announces points of interest, all using GPS. Noe's point in mentioning Blind Square to Nigel is that it is a tool that he can work with within his set of limitations. Noe spent his whole life navigating the world one way, his way, and eSight would actually change that, maybe more than he would want.
I've never really seen a subway map anyway, so I would have to get a hang of how it works first. Right. And then...
Because your brain needs to recognize it and then know what it's looking at.
Right, exactly.
Right.
That's the
Which
thing.
It's hard for human beings to comprehend, I think.
Yeah, it's like imagining a new color.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, Julian, eSight worked, but it wasn't perfect for no way.
And I think it's important to know that eSight is actually really a cool technology, whether or not it worked for him. Nigel mentioned that many elderly people who suffer from macular degeneration, losing their sight due to old age, have been able to see their grandchildren for the first time, which is really cool. I mean, it does restore sight for a lot of people who've seen before.
Noe said the sacrifices he makes to get around to his gigs as a blind person aren't so bad. But there is one part of his career that's less easy to navigate. Like many musicians, Noe uses his social media channels as his primary way of connecting to his current fans and hopefully reaching future ones. The problem is, it's pretty hard to reach your fans on Instagram if you're blind.
Instagram needs to listen to me right now. Basically, the issue is this. Editing videos and putting the part that you want is not accessible on Instagram. You know, thankfully, the Apple app is accessible. So I edit it on the iPhone app because there is like sliders and it tells you like current position, 0 seconds of like 2 minutes and 30 seconds. And so basically you slide with your finger up and down. If it wasn't for that, I wouldn't be able to post on Instagram. I would only be able to post the first minute, which is not what I always want to post on the songs. Sometimes I post some other part, you know, but Instagram hasn't implemented yet because, you know, blind people aren't supposed to be on Instagram.
I'd never thought about this. Digital technology is almost exclusively visual. I don't think about how easy it is for me to use an iPhone every day. I just use it.
And when you have these technologies like iPhones being designed by people in Silicon Valley who fit pretty healthily within the norm, it's not really doing Noe any favors. And when we focus on the next big thing in tech, we can leapfrog past uses for these existing technologies. So we say, okay, well, where's our next big unicorn? We want to do these miraculous, gigantic ideas, but you don't think about subway maps, you don't think about things like Blind Square unless you actually need that app.
And I think we're not anti-technology or anti-unicorn. Those things are important. You know, right. Noe actually said something really funny, which is that, like, he would love a self-driving car. Of course he would.
Yeah.
So we all benefit from these moonshot innovations, but it's really important, I think, that everyone thinks about who is forgotten when we innovate too quickly. We don't all benefit in the same ways.
We began this episode debating what defines a cyborg and asking how close we are to being transhuman. These are important philosophical questions, and they may even become practical questions in our lifetime. But as we wrestle with them, it's important to remember that a huge number of people still don't have access to technologies that most of us take for granted to expand our horizons and what we can do. There are billions of people in the world who don't have smartphones, and millions of people in the US, like Noe, who can't take full advantage of them. Bryony Cole is tackling this problem head-on. After working at Microsoft, she founded The Future of Sex, and as part of her work, she produces sex tech hackathons around the world.
I think it's so important is because no one's talking about it. We all got here by having sex. Our sexual identity is so core to who we are. And the concentration of people innovating in this field is quite small.
So, Kara, I was a bit nervous to talk about sex in this episode because I didn't want people to think we're being sensational for the sake of it. But it is an area where we can see the tangible consequences of what happens when one group designs for the rest, like with Noe.
I don't think it's sensational at all. It's like with Gillian in episode one. When people programming ads for Facebook do not understand different outcomes for pregnancy, they don't know that an outcome for pregnancy could be stillbirth. And that's how Gillian's ads were making her life worse.
Because the people programming them are men, by and large.
By and large.
You know, it takes these edge cases like Gillian being haunted by targeted ads for us to notice that. More often than not, we don't have a counterfactual. We can't make a comparison to a version of technology that wasn't built by Silicon Valley. And that is exactly why Bryony Cole organizes events to design new sex tech.
While hackathons sound really geeky and typically you're going to attract just people involved in technology, we were really careful in structuring the hackathon, inviting other people in from other classes, from other ethnicities, from other genders to allow us to build different sorts of products. What was the surprise that we didn't design for was people with disabilities that showed up.
And with these new groups of people came new kinds of products.
One team came up with a voice-activated vibrator for people in wheelchairs. Another team in Singapore, a deaf man, a blind man, built a sex intimacy education platform about bringing a woman back to their dorm room and really not knowing how to read intimacy cues because they've never been taught. These people just showed up and went, thank you. We feel invisible.
Technology very quickly becomes part of our homeostasis. We take for granted the fact that we have a supercomputer as our constant companion and that we can summon the entire corpus of human knowledge with the flick of a finger. But as we constantly focus on the next frontier, what's new, it's easy to forget that many people don't get to share in the fruits of what we've already built.
Other populations that also resonate with the hackathons, people in remote areas or rural populations that have trouble finding a mate, and of course women, which is predominantly who turns up to these hackathons, 80%. It's people that typically don't have access to this, providing input into how we build it.
Bryony's hackathons allow people who feel invisible to create products directly for themselves, people who may even be invisible on the campuses of Silicon Valley. For Bryony, access begins at the design phase, and including new voices can create new products and technological surprises that otherwise might not exist. So perhaps her hackathons could serve as a model for tech innovation more broadly.
I think where I'd most like to see it go is to sort of the trickle-down effect across the world in terms of how that technology reaches other populations, because it is so concentrated in these like Silicon Valley types. It's the access that I'm more excited about. We actually have incredible technology available to us, and yet the uses right now are so clunky. You know, and we just need to figure out how we're going to use it and who we're going to invite in.
Bryony paints a picture of a world where the benefits of godlike technology spread to all people. But as we've talked about before on Sleepwalkers, there's a very real possibility that technology will be co-opted by the rich and powerful. So we had to ask, who gets to become a cyborg? And what if the new gods don't want to share their divinity? Here's Yuval again.
One disturbing thought is that there is no us, there is no we. Different groups of humans have a very different future, and they should prepare themselves in a different way. It could lead to the creation of a new caste system with immense differences in wealth and power, much greater than we ever saw before in history. It could even lead to speciation, Homo sapiens splitting into different species with different capabilities. So the descendants of Elon Musk will be a different species than the descendants of people who are now living in some favela in Sao Paulo. There is a big question always, what is the future of humanity? What should we do? What is our future?
What is the future of our humanity? What are we sleepwalking towards? It's tempting to look for the dramatic ways technology is changing us. Might we be able to physically merge with computers? Will computer vision help the blind see or the marginalized experience intimacy? They're big questions, but there's one that's even more urgent. How is the AI revolution already changing the way we think about and perceive the world? What are the algorithms we interact with every day doing to us? And how are they changing our society? More on those questions with Yuval Noah Harari when we come back.
Until I was 21, I didn't know I was gay. And I look back at the time when I was, 15 or 17, and I just can't understand how I missed it. I mean, it should have been so obvious, but the fact is, I didn't know an extremely important thing about myself, which an AI could have discovered within, 2 minutes.
For Yuval Noah Harari, AI could have made a big difference to his early life, and that got him thinking.
When we talk about AI, we tend to greatly exaggerate the potential abilities, but at the same time, we also tend to exaggerate the abilities of humans. People say that AI is not going to take over our lives because it's very imperfect and it won't be able to know us perfectly. But what people forget is that humans often have a very poor understanding of themselves, of their desires, of their emotions, of their mental states. For AI to take over your life, it doesn't need to know you perfectly. It just needs to know you better than you know yourself. And that's not very difficult because we often don't know the most important things about ourselves.
So, but let's say you could turn back the clock to being 15. Would you have wanted to live in a world where there were sufficiently good sensors to monitor your eyes, your eye movement, your breathing, you know, while you're going about your daily life, and then to interpret that and say to you, Yuval, more likely than not, you're gay?
That's a very good question, which will become a very practical question in a few years. And the way that I grew up and developed, it would have been a very bad idea. I wouldn't like to receive this kind of insight from a machine. I'm not sure how I would have dealt with it when I was 15, you know, in Israel in the 1980s. And maybe partly it was, you know, a defense mechanism. In the future, too, it depends where you live. Brunei has instituted a death penalty for gay people, at least for people engaged in homosexual sex. So if I'm a teenager in Brunei, I don't want to be told by the computer that I'm gay, because the computer will then be able to tell that to the police and to the authorities as well. Looking to the future, say 10, 20 years, the danger is, if I still don't know that I'm gay, but the government and Coca-Cola and Amazon and Google, they already know it, I'm at a huge disadvantage. So it could be something as frightening as the secret police coming and taking me to a concentration camp, but it could also be something like Coca-Cola knowing that I'm gay, they want to sell me a new drink, and they choose the advertisement with the shirtless guy and not the advertisement with the girl in the bikini. And next day morning, I go and I buy this soft drink and I don't even know why. And they have this huge advantage over me and can manipulate me in all kinds of ways.
What Yuval suggests is that once we become reducible to data, we become predictable to algorithms. And once we're predictable, we can be manipulated. We talked in the last episode about how AI is helping us decode life's fundamental mysteries, brainwaves, health outcomes based on genetics, time of death. But the next frontier could be our very behavior. Here's Arthi again.
We have tools to evaluate vast volumes of data that we have previously collected or that we've always collected. We have new sources of data. Think about everything from Fitbits and those kinds of measurements that you can make on individuals to the volume of data that people are spewing out into the online environment every day.
The implications of spewing this data onto the internet is where we began the series. And knowing that your data is being used to build an accurate model of you may give you pause about putting it out there. But it's the combination of that data with advances in AI that's allowing us to start to see into the future.
Data plus that deep knowledge now allows you to form hypotheses and to design experiments that allow us now to start a journey of building better models of these complex systems. This is at the core of the revolution that we're seeing. But I think the next wave after starting to understand biology is about a transformation in the social sciences.
Of course, in some ways, that transformation in the social sciences is already here. It's what Yuval was talking about in terms of computers that understand us better than we understand ourselves. And we've already seen the real-world consequences altering the course of history with Cambridge Analytica, Brexit, and the 2016 presidential election. But Yuval believes that was just the beginning, and this revolution in biology and computer science will shake the very foundations of how we live.
The ideology of humanism basically says that the human experience is the ultimate source of authority and meaning in the universe. If you look at politics, then if originally political authority came from the gods, now political authority comes from humanity. The idea is that the voter is always right. You look at economics, there the motto, the slogan is the customer is always right. If the customers want something, then however irrational and illogical it is, this is what the entire system is geared to provide. And you have the same idea in ethics. Why is it wrong to murder? Not because some god said so, but because it hurts other people. So we already view ourselves in this sense as kind of divine entities that provide meaning and authority to the world. The big question is what happens once some algorithm can decipher and manipulate human feelings and experiences, then they can no longer be the source of authority if it's so easy to hack and manipulate them. And this is part of the crisis which we are already beginning to see today.
This crisis is the intersection, the culmination of many of the ideas that we've spoken about on this first season of Sleepwalkers. And it's why it's so urgently important not to ignore the changes going on around us and to wake up.
If we refuse to see it, if we just hold on to this liberal belief that humans are free agents, we have free will, nobody will ever be able to understand me, nobody will ever be able to manipulate me. If you really believe that, then you are not open to the danger and you won't be able to reinvent the system in a better way.
Not everyone agrees that we've reached the point Yuval describes. According to Arthi, there's a world of mystery that we've barely begun to penetrate.
I think we are so far from having a full understanding of any of these systems. The fact that we are making this rapid, accelerated progress, I think sometimes leads to a hyperbolic sense that we're going to know everything and it'll all get reduced to a bunch of algorithms. And I don't think we're anywhere near that. And I'm not even sure that's the end point.
Not the end point, in the sense that that will never happen, or there may be an end point beyond that?
My own view is that what it means to be human is so much richer than these mechanistic components that we're talking about. You know, if you said to me, when do you think we will fully map and be able to predict behavioral systems? My answer might be never.
The incredible depth of these systems, how messy and organic they are, means we've got a long way to go before we've understood everything. The uniqueness of our humanity lives to fight another day. But, as Yuval said, for AI to profoundly influence us, it doesn't need a perfect understanding. It just needs to know a little bit more than we do. And that's becoming a reality. So what should we do?
On the individual level, it's more urgent than ever to get to know yourself better, because you have competition. Once there is somebody out there, a system out there, an algorithm out there that knows you better than you know yourself, the game is up. You can do something about it, not just by withholding data, but above all, by improving your own understanding of yourself. The better you understand yourself, the more difficult it is to manipulate you.
Know thyself. Yuval references the ancient Greek maxim. And last episode, Siddhartha Mukherjee called our attention to the Hippocratic Oath. In the midst of the incredible upheavals of modernity, we're being urged to remember the wisdom of the ancients. But how do we get to know ourselves better?
I meditate, some people go to therapy. Whatever works for you, do it and do it quickly. Get to know yourself better, because this is your best protection against being hacked. If you're an engineer, then one of the best things you can do for humanity is build AI sidekicks that serve individuals and not corporations or governments. AI systems that, yes, they monitor you and they analyze you and they hack you, but they serve you. They reveal what they find to you, and they work like an antivirus, just like your computer has an antivirus. So your brain also needs an antivirus. And this is something that AI can do for us, to protect us against other malevolent AIs.
Of course, one of the problems we've talked about on the series is that the vast majority of talented engineers work for the very corporations Yuval says we need to be protected from. But there is something compelling about using technology as a tool to protect ourselves from other technology. And Bryony Cole also sees avenues for technology to help us get to know ourselves better. We can explore in virtual worlds without shame.
It's pushing us to reveal ourselves, even things we didn't even know about ourselves. If we think about, wow, this dark and wacky world of sexuality that we haven't even explored ourselves because we've been too afraid of what we might discover, you put technology in there where you're suddenly able to create any world that you want. These totally fantastical edges of our minds that we can go to thanks to technology.
And according to Bryony, this is not just about seeking thrills. our sexuality is actually driven by something much more profound.
The core of our humanity, we want to connect, we want to belong, we want to feel like we're part of something. That's sort of like the core part of that, right down to our sexuality. What is the future of sex? The answer has nothing to do with technology, and it always has to do with being human.
We can take great strides personally to get to know ourselves better, but we also have to recognize the limits of what we can achieve as individuals. To create a technological future that is fair and positive, we need governance and policy. Here's Yuval again.
We need to regulate things like the ownership of data and the immense power, the divine powers of creation, of being able to engineer and create life. This should be a major political issue of who owns these kinds of abilities. This is not something you can do by yourself. So here, my best recommendation is join an organization. 50 people in an organization can do far, far more than 500 individual activists. So whatever cause seems to you the most important, join a relevant organization and do it this week.
The AI revolution isn't far off in the future, Kara. As Yuval says, it's here with us, and we have this personal and political responsibility to make sure that the future is a future we want to live in.
Yeah, I think that's actually a good place to leave season one of Sleepwalkers.
Don't go breaking my heart.
Yeah, it's been incredible to hear you say, comma, Kara. But also, it's been incredible to report on, you know, to meet people like Noé and Gillian Brockhell or Glenn Rodriguez, and to understand how this new technology is affecting people's lives.
It's been a real privilege to hear those stories, and also to get access to some of the people who are building the technologies we live by. People like Yasmin Green at Google's Jigsaw, Nathaniel Gleitcher, Facebook's head of cybersecurity, and Ben Singleton, director of analytics at the NYPD. We got to hear firsthand what these leaders in the world of technology are thinking about, and how hard they wrestle with the ethics of their creations.
And there are so many more areas that AI is transforming and that we're going to look at in season two. You know, things like money and climate change. And some of the problems that I've noticed even since we started doing this podcast, like what happens if your boss is an algorithm?
Well, that's why we're doing a season two of Sleepwalkers. So please join us. And in the meantime, we'll be keeping our Instagram, Twitter, and website updated.
That's at Sleepwalkers Podcast on Instagram and at Sleepwalkers Pod on Twitter. And if you have any stories, suggestions, or criticisms, send us an email.
At sleepwalkerspress@iheartmedia.com. That's sleepwalkerspress at iheartmedia.com. Well, that's all from us. I'm Oz Voloshin, and we'll see you next time. Sleepwalkers is a production of iHeartRadio and Unusual Productions. For the latest AI news, live interviews, and behind-the-scenes footage, find us on Instagram at Sleepwalkers Podcast or at sleepwalkerspodcast.com. Special thanks this episode to The Forward, the digital news and culture website, and Jonathan and Cody from the SEO agency Make It All Work here in New York City.
And thanks to Noé Socha, that's S-O-C-H-A, for his involvement in this episode. If you'd like to hear more of Noé's music, you can find him on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram at Simple Blues Boy.
Thanks also to Ellen Ullman, author of Life in Code, and Gary Marcus of Robust.ai, who gave generous interviews which helped shape our thinking for this series. Sleepwalkers is hosted by me, Oz Voloshin.
And co-hosted by me, Kara Price.
We're produced by Julian Weller, with help from Jacopo Penzo and Taylor Chicoin. Mixing by Tristan McNeil and Julian Weller. Our story editor is Matthew Riddle. Recording assistance this episode from Joanne DeLuna and Sabrina Bowden. Sleepwalkers is executive produced by me, Oz Voloshin, and Mangesh Hatikada. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.